Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Basically, the Rubicon has been crossed long ago. From Greece to Ireland, the bondholders are always to be made 100% whole. Whatever poverty, whatever suffering, whatever starvation the population could possibly endure, just like during the Irish potato famine, you know, no matter what, the monarchy of England had to be fed, despite all the starvation of the people of Ireland. With these TPP-type trade deals, also the same sort of crossing of the Rubicon, is that we will create this contract globally whereby no sovereign vote from any population, no stupid peasants could possibly get in our way of our divine right to profit. Here, he's joining with what happened to Greece and in Ireland to a lesser extent. But in Greece, you know, the same population voted against austerity. And of course, the European Union and the Troika smashed them. So here he's saying the bondholders are the number one important thing. It doesn't matter what you, the people, want. You might be fed up with the suffering and you want our laws changed and you want our economy and the way we're running our economy change, but the bondholders run our economy.
Aye, democracy, we hardly knew ya. That was Max Keiser's partner, Stacey Herbert, talking about a decision this week by the president of Portugal, who refused to seat the winners of a national election despite having won a resounding victory based on their promise to sweep out the austerity-driven euro financiers who have been causing such public hardship in recent years by strangling the economy in order to pay debt service to the global banks. Democracy, schmamocracy. Hello, I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, back with another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. This week we take a look at the political realities we face in trying to make a sea change in control of our money from the entrenched political powers who prioritize profits over everything and move it into the hands of the people who would prioritize, well, people. Our guest today is Dr. Thomas Marois of the University of London, a global expert on public banks and how well they're working around the world and why it's going to take a broad-based political and social movement to reclaim that sovereign right of the people if we intend to succeed in overpowering the bondholders and bankers who obviously have no concern about trampling democracies and public interest. As Stacey Herbert pointed out in her opening comments, and as we discuss on this program, this is a critical battle now enjoined in many corners of the world, and one that we must get actively involved with if we hope to recover some semblance of a democratic future. In just a minute, we'll talk with Ellen about some of the monetary stories that are in play stateside, including a look at the latest edition of the recurring charade over the U.S. debt ceiling, as well as how some other countries have devised alternative monetary methods for engaging global trade. Like money itself, this program has roots in lots of other countries. Later on, Matt Standard will share another view of why postal banking should be embraced by all of us, and not just Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But now, let's talk with Ellen.
Ellen, I wanted to ask you, we're looking at another debt ceiling crisis, and I know your new article deals with that, but before getting into some of the details in your article, people want to know, from whom are we borrowing money? Why do they receive interest? And why? Why do we have a debt that a sovereign nation shouldn't have? I mean, who do we owe money to?
Yeah, exactly. Why do we have a debt that we shouldn't have? I mean, it's one thing to have the debt, but then you're paying interest, which is, by some calculations, our entire debt is interest. In other words, if we had only had to pay the principal, going back to 1835, the last time the debt was actually paid off, we would have no debt today, but interest compounds. So if you have a 30-year bond issue, it's the same as a 30-year mortgage. You're going to double, you're going to pay as much again in interest as you pay in principal. And that's what Thomas Edison was complaining about in the 1920s. Henry Ford was complaining, and then Thomas Edison wrote about it, that there was an infrastructure project they wanted to do. And they said, you know, why is it that we're going to wind up paying double by the time we pay interest on this to the bondholders? Why don't we just issue the money directly? And now that we know, money reformers have known it for a long time, but the Bank of England has actually formally come out and acknowledged that banks do not actually lend their depositors money, that they create the money they lend on their books. So if they're just creating it on their books, why don't we let the government do that, as was provided in the Constitution? The Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And at that time, coins were the official money supply. So basically that meant Congress shall have the power to issue the money supply. If you regulate the value, you're not going according to the market value. So that was the solution I proposed.
So at what point then did we get into borrowing our money?
I think they borrowed money all the way back to Andrew Jackson paid off the debt in 1835. So there was
right.
obviously a debt that the country had to begin with. It was a debt that was left over from the Revolutionary War, and then they weren't able to, they tried to use gold as their sole medium, and there just wasn't enough gold. So then they set up the first U.S. bank and the second U.S. bank, which were basically doing fractional reserve lending, where they put the gold in the bank, and then they were able to issue a lot of, they didn't have digital money then, but they issued paper money, which was supposedly backed by gold, but it wasn't.
So the debt has been purchased by municipalities and cities and counties and states, but also private investors and pension funds, all buying U.S. bonds, and that's the money that we're using for financing our government, essentially?
Right, and the first purchaser of those bonds are big banks, the 22 or so banks that are allowed to purchase government bonds, and then they resell them, and what they purchase them with is just accounting entries. So why not just issue it as accounting entries, which is actually what they did do up till 1935. I mean, they were able to lend directly to the government up till 1935, but at that point, the Federal Reserve itself was keeping the interest, and then there were protests that it made it too easy for Congress to just, you know, print and spend all the money that they wanted to, and so they routed it through these banks, so the banks got their cut of everything, and then at some point, they took away the Federal, the Federal Reserve had to rebate the interest.
They had to rebate the interest to the U.S. government.
Right. But it's all just sort of, you know, the left hand and the right hand. I mean, it's all right. Just shuffling money created as accounting entries. But somehow that power got shifted over to the private banks, which should have been a power of the government or public banks, or, you know, if the Federal Reserve were actually federal and were actually acting on behalf of the people, and if it were just issuing money as opposed to issuing it as a loan that had to be repaid with interest.
So the 22 banks that you just mentioned, those were the same 22 banks that were accused not too many months ago of manipulating Treasury notes and values, right?
Certainly some of them. I haven't actually looked, but...
But generally, the point being that the large banks that are engaged in these Treasury purchases were also positioning to manipulate the expenses or the amounts of payment.
But the big issue right now is the debt ceiling, which we shouldn't even have a debt ceiling because it's in the Constitution that the debts shall not be questioned. The debt has clearly been incurred. That's the 14th Amendment. The debt has clearly been incurred when... Congress passed the budget. So they incur the debt, they spend the money, and then at the end of the year if they don't get in enough taxes to balance their books, then they issue bonds to make up the difference. So that's all been approved. I mean, you can't spend the money and have the contractors get the money and then say we're not going to pay on the bonds, which is paid to the creditors. Although it seems to me that way to solve that permanently is don't borrow, just issue the money directly, which we still could do. We could do it as U.S. notes, as Abraham Lincoln did in the Civil War. In fact, he did. At one point, the U.S. notes or greenbacks were 40% of the money supply. So today, that would be like $5 trillion, a huge amount of money for the time. And it still didn't create hyperinflation like everybody thinks it would. In fact, they had all that money to fund all sorts of development that they didn't have before. It was a very a very productive era.
Well, so if the Constitution says we are not to question the creditability of the U.S. government, why did this rule get passed by Congress, and can it not be challenged?
Well, it was passed back after World War I, supposedly to make it easier for Congress to pay their bills, because it used to be that they had to approve every expenditure individually. So they said, well, we'll just put a blanket sum on it and say you're not supposed to go over X amount, and then you can go ahead and figure out how you're going to spend it. But they set it nice and high so it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't actually be hit. But eventually then it would be hit, but it was always raised until, I guess, the first time that they disputed it was in 1953, when Eisenhower wanted to build the national highway system, which is, you know, controversial. Can you imagine if we didn't have a national highway system?
Wow.
Everybody now thinks that was a great thing to do, but no, there were people in Congress that wanted to dispute whether we should have a highway system, and so they capped, you know, the debt ceiling. And that had to be fought over. And then we fought over it three times just in the last 4 years. So this is getting quite old.
And you're proposing that Obama could take an action to make him a hero in history. What does that look like?
Well, Obama said at the beginning of his administration, he was supposedly modeling his administration after Abraham Lincoln, who was his mentor and guide. And so when Obama was talking about this, he was not talking about issuing the money. Hardly anybody even knows outside of money reformers. I mean, I guess now people know more, but it used to be people just weren't even aware that Lincoln had issued money directly to pay for a large portion of the North's debts in the Civil War. But Lincoln did do that, and Obama could follow by doing the same thing. He could issue U.S. notes, except, I mean, it would take legislation, and there's no time for that, obviously, before November 3rd. But what he could do that could be done very quickly is mint a couple of platinum coins, or one platinum coin would do it for $1 trillion. And we went through this in 2013, where a number of economists looked at it and said, yep, that would work.
Well, talking about Congress, the Dodd-Frank legislation around banking is under fire for complicating the lives of our much-needed community bankers. So what's that all about?
Well, purpose of Dodd-Frank supposedly was to prevent too big to fail and to prevent bailouts. And Obama went on TV and said, you know, there'll be no more bailouts because now we have Dodd-Frank. But what it really did was substitute bail-ins for bailouts, which means that now it'll be the depositors who will be on the hook instead of the taxpayers, which is, it's either us, you know, or it's us either way. And they've basically done is institutionalized too big to fail, and they've made the too big to fail banks bigger than they were before, a lot bigger, 30% bigger since 2010 when that bill was passed, and 80% bigger than before the 2008 crisis. I mean, originally they got bigger by absorbing the other banks that were in trouble, like Washington Mutual and Bear Stearns. But since 2010, it was the little banks that actually weathered the crisis well, and since 2010, 1,500 banks have disappeared, largely because they've sold out to the big banks. And the reason they've sold out is they can't comply with Dodd-Frank. Partly it's just the paperwork. It's a 2,300-page bill, and you have to sort through all that and figure out what you're supposed to do, fill out a lot of paperwork. So they have to hire extra people to do that, which is pricey. And also the capital requirements have been raised, so it's getting more and more difficult to make profitable loans. So what I was writing about was that there were some insiders who were saying or hinting that the actual intent of Dodd-Frank was to get rid of the little banks because it was supposedly easier to regulate a few big banks than a lot of little banks. Of course, we know it was the big banks. Their lobbyists basically wrote the bill, so of course it serves the big bank. But the problem is that the little banks serve a whole different market than the big banks. It's the little banks that make the loans to the small and medium-sized businesses who do most of the hiring. They make loans to homeowners that wouldn't otherwise qualify within the sort of cookie-cutter computer models of the big banks. And the big banks just aren't really interested nowadays. Now they're busy doing their derivatives and buying big commodities and other things.
And speaking of Congress and banking, you had mentioned that in the Hillary hearings over Libya, over the Benghazi thing, you think there's something else behind that Libya action that was even more fundamental to what happened in Libya?
What were we doing in Libya in the first place? And I assume the reason they didn't look at that is that it was a bipartisan thing. I mean, it was pushed, I'm sure, by the big international banking interests in the first place, and both sides agreed to it. So if they investigated, they'd be investigating themselves. But Libya actually had democracy. It was more democratic than we are, probably. They had communities that you could actually vote in your community for local legislation. Individuals could vote. They had a central bank that was owned by the government and that funded public infrastructure. For instance, the big one was the Great Man-Made River Project, I guess it was called, which was actually was primary water. It was water that came out of rock, so it was very ancient water that went way, way down. And the way they funded that was with a publicly owned bank that could just issue the money directly, plus the government did issue the national currency, plus Gaddafi nationalized the oil industry many years ago, and so he used the profits from oil to fund all sorts of projects, things for the people. And all those things, of course, are going to annoy the Western big bank. And
well,
maybe the worst thing he did was to try to mobilize the African nations to set up an alternative to the IMF, which would be the African Monetary Fund, and to use a different currency, to use a gold-backed currency.
You know, it's really interesting. We're seeing so much motion around monetary control and reform in other countries around the world now for a variety of reasons. But a rather stunning thing, Portugal, I mean, they just unilaterally undid a democratic vote to prevent people who want to get out of austerity from taking power.
Yeah. Well, in Greece, we saw what happened to the left wing when it got in. But in Portugal, they're not even letting it in. So the parliament voted in a very left-wing government, and the president refused to inaugurate them and said that, you know, we've never in 40 years gone up against the EU, that it would undo all the work they had done for austerity. In other words, all the austerity they had imposed on the people in order to try to cut back their debt would go for naught, because now they would be doing things like actually fund things that would actually help the people. So they're reversing policies and the threat of leaving the Eurozone, although apparently the coalition government that was going to form had already agreed not to do those more radical things. So democracy is over in the Eurozone, it seems, if you're a struggling country.
And in Spain, something similar. The Catalonians are trying to secede, and were they issuing some of their own money too?
Yeah, well, it's Barcelona versus Madrid.
Yeah.
Where the Barcelonians say, we're going to just issue our own. But what was interesting, it's digital, and it's tradable in euros, but they're setting it at one-to-one. In other words, they're not allowing this new digital currency to be manipulated by short sellers and sharks and speculators. They're saying, nope, trade's at one-to-one, take it or leave it, basically.
Uh-huh.
And they did the same thing in Ecuador, which I thought was really interesting, that the Ecuador government has, ever since January, they've been issuing a digital dollar. They trade in U.S. dollars. That's their official currency. So what they have to do is get in these boatloads of dollars in order just to conduct trade. So the government said, well, we're not going to just pay our bills with this. We're just using it to help trade because we have that problem where we have to get these paper dollars in all the time. But again, what they did was they set it at one-to-one. They said, our digital dollars are going to be worth a dollar. And that's it. Take it or leave it. And the people are taking it. So they've been taking it since January. It's getting more and more popular. And you can have an account at the central bank, which I think is the ideal. I mean, I think that's where we're going. I think that's the ideal model overall, would be to have one big banking system, like this great big digital bank in the clouds, which is basically just a big community currency system where we all keep our credits. Your credits are your credits. There's no reason why some bank going bankrupt is going to wipe out your credits. They're just numbers up there on a screen. You've earned them, they're yours. And when the big digital public bank makes a loan, they do like all banks do, which is just create the money digitally, you know, create it with accounting entries. They don't have to borrow it from somewhere else. We now know that banks don't borrow that money from somewhere else. They just create it.
Yeah, and of course the post office would be a nice nearby place to take those transactions someday too, if we would get to postal banking, as Matt will be talking about later on. Well, Ellen, there's a lot going on in the world, and it seems like public banking is on the rise. You and I both know there's a tremendous amount of new interest in public banking as a way of reforming some of the monetary issues that we've got, and we'll see what happens next.
Right. Yeah, I think it had to all play out. Like, they had to try the bailouts, et cetera, as if regulation would work. But now we've seen it. Regulation does not work. Dodd-Frank didn't work. So now we have to just redo the whole system.
Well, thanks so much, Ellen. And we will talk next time about what has happened to the world since the last time we spoke.
Okay. Thank you. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Marwah, Senior Lecturer at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. Dr. Marwah has written a great deal about public banking, particularly in developing countries, and is a strong proponent of it. It's great to be talking to you, Thomas.
Thank you very much, Ellen. I'm very pleased to have a chance to speak with you about public banking, and I've been following the Public Banking Institute's work for quite a while, and so it's a great honor to be able to contribute.
Oh, and it's a great honor to have you writing on this. I mean, you've gone into great detail and things that are of great interest to me, and I think probably to our listeners, too. One was a lengthy paper you wrote that was called State-Owned Banks and Development, Dispelling Mainstream Myths. You list 9 different myths. I wonder if you could go into some of them, your favorites, and explain why they are myths.
Sure. Just a little context for that paper. It was something that I did together with a research group called the Municipal Services Project, who also do a lot of work on public services, but more around health, electrical provisioning, water provisioning in particular. And I'd known some of the people for quite a while, and then they really recognized there was a big gap in their work in terms of public banking as a service, but also as something that can support other public sector enterprises and public provisioning of basic goods and things like that. So that's where I became involved with them, and they asked me to write something up on the state of public banking in general. And we decided that a good way to enter into that would be to discuss some of the myths, if you will, or the mainstream conventional economic ideas that have taken root in the literature and in our thoughts over the last 20 or 30 years under neoliberalism. And one of the first things that really struck out, and it was a myth that I myself had believed, or thought was fairly true, having done my first research on privatization, which is that, one of the myths is that there's no state-owned banks left, in a sense. Particularly in developed countries or advanced capitalisms, we tend to believe that, they're all sort of been privatized and it's a thing of the past. But doing some research into it, one, we found out that, believe it or not, at least 25% of all banks globally are still state-owned in one form or another, state-owned, state-controlled, which is an immense, amount of institutional capacity that's under public control. And then doing a little more in-depth research into that, especially looking at developing poor middle-income countries, you can see that a huge range of variety therein, where places like Costa Rica will have 60-70% state-owned banks, as well as India, China obviously being an outstander there with massive, globally powerful banks. But across the spectrum, there's still a number of countries that have anywhere from a third or more control in the public sector, in public banks. And this means that there's a lot of really significant material capacity, like control over money, that can be mobilized for developmental and progressive ends. That doesn't necessarily mean it will be, but that it can be. Then another myth that I explored is one that is very prominent within the mainstream literature when promoted, ironically, if you will, by the World Bank. World Bank itself being a state-owned bank. You might want to call it a self-hating state-owned bank if you wanted to. But their myth is, as they repeat and promote, is that bureaucrats make bad bankers. as I bring up in the paper. And it's a phrase that, in fact, they use, and supporters or researchers within the paradigm use. And it's a very unfortunate one. There are, as in any type of organization, can be bad management practices, but to assert that that is the nature of public banks is historically wrong, and it just erases a lot of the diversity and very positive things that people working on the ground do. At that time, I was interviewing a lot of bank workers, frontline workers, managers, supervisors in Turkey, and I was quite surprised and impressed by the underlying public ethos that a lot of these people working in the state-owned banks, one of them being Zira Bank, which is an agricultural bank, another one being Halk Bank, which has historically been geared towards tradespersons, cooperatives, small, medium-sized enterprises, that sort of thing. And these are banks that have been around for more than 80 years, so they have a long history. And the people working had a real sense that the bank itself had contributed positively to national development, had contributed positively to a sense of publicness in the country, and that they had done a lot of good historically in the development of Turkey, but also in support of local communities of farmers, of cooperatives, and these sorts of things that were quite impressive. Now, of course, you know, things change with neoliberalism, and a lot of that, the mandates of public banks towards supporting more progressive social goals often have been eroded or undermined by neoliberal restructuring and marketization. But nonetheless, people remember, and they have, you know, bank workers in a lot of different places in the country have a real concern that the role they can play is being undermined by increasingly market-driven imperatives, profit imperatives, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. It's great that they have that history because we don't. And you wrote about that the political will is an important factor, for example, in Venezuela. If you have a government that has the power to issue money, which all governments do, either directly or if that's too controversial, then through their state-owned banks, because all banks, as we now know, create money. I mean, that's where all our money comes from these days, is from bank loans. So if you have that power, it's just a matter of the political will, like we saw in World War II in the U.S. If the government decides to find the money, they can find the money, just issue it or create it as loans or borrow it out of money created by your central bank or whatever. But in our case, we've got a government that's bent on drowning government in a bathtub. They want to get rid of government. I wonder if you could go into that, perhaps example of Venezuela, and how we might recapture the political will ourselves. That's why I like these examples of other countries, because we just don't have that. Or we have it, but it's way far back in our history, and people have forgotten it.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I think an underlying point that we have to remember in the current conjuncture where everything is supposed to be, you know, economically driven, economically rational, is that there is no solid economic argument against public banks or their efficiency. It's if you want public banks, it's a political decision, and there has to be political will behind that. And you can see the impact of that internationally, all these different examples that we can go into, the United States versus somewhere like Venezuela, where they didn't have many state-owned banks through the 1980s and 90s, but then in the midst of crisis in 2007-2008, the then-Chavez government was looking to acquire a bank that was up for sale. You know, it was freely up for sale, but as soon as the government sort of decided that they wanted to buy it, exert political will and exert some sort of force over the largely foreign-owned and privately-owned banking sector, then the owners of the bank withheld the offer, and they said, we don't want to sell it to you, to the government. But then the crisis hits, and in a sense, you know, Chavez said, we're going to buy the bank, and we're going to pay, they agreed to pay fair market value, whatever that means, and then brought that into the realm of the state, and then proceeded to absorb a range of other private banks that had been failing amidst the crisis, brought them together and created a fairly substantial state-owned bank, bringing up control of over money resources in the country from, I believe, somewhere around 8 or 9% to somewhere around, I believe, 30% presently, you know, as a matter of political will. But there's also a lot of other different examples that are hugely inspiring and interesting. Places like Costa Rica, which I know you have brought up and mentioned, where the banks were nationalized in the 1940s and have been largely state-owned since then. And the political will behind it, and then the kind of what I call social content, the institutional and the cultural, historical, political content of the banks that becomes institutionalized over time, has created banks that have in Costa Rica both the worker-owned cooperative bank, Banco Popular, and the Banco Nacional de Costa Rica, you know, some very clear mandates around things that are very important today, that we have to seriously consider environmental concerns, questions for democracy, participation, and these really key questions that under corporatized banking, private, corporatized, profit-maximizing banking, simply do not matter in a sense. They only matter to the extent that a bank might be able to sell its products better under corporate social responsibility guise of being green. But in effect, in the day in, day out, there's very little effect that the average citizen can have over the choices that a private bank has to fund or not fund progressive projects. And so the key really in building something in the U.S. or here in the U.K. where I teach, or home where I'm originally from, home in Alberta, Canada, is a question of political will. And building a social movement, building real capacity to exert control over the creation of money and where it goes, and then the conditions by which that's lent, either favorable or more favorable to some groups than others. And that's entirely political, and it's not an economic question.
Mm-hmm. I think in those other countries where the political will has come to the fore, it's because they've seen the failure of the private system. And I think we'll probably, if we haven't seen it already, we're going to see it in the next crisis. So that's why I think that it's really important that people have these other examples of public banking, that they know there are state-owned banks, that they know that possibility is out there and they know what can be achieved through it. I know, for example, in the Reserve Bank of New Zealand was supposed to be a private, the central bank was supposed to be a private entity, and then there was this, suddenly there was a populist movement, I think it was a social credit movement, that took over the government and they turned it into a publicly owned entity that issued credit for the purposes of the government and did some remarkable things with it until the Bank of England leaned on them and they went back to being basically, you know, largely private. And also the Bank of Canada originally was private, and then there was this, again, a social movement, the political will that the Prime Minister declared that it should be a publicly owned institution, and they did amazing things with it for 35 years. And another thing you wrote on, and I would like to hear you go into, is about Turkey and how it succumbed, as everybody else did in the 1970s and 1980s, to this push for, you know, the neoliberal agenda, that the very high interest rates that impoverished all the third world countries, and that also struck in Canada, and that's what happened to their remarkable state-owned banking model. So Turkey was another thing you wrote about at length, and it's something that was an example that I miss. So I'm really interested to hear your exposition of their early history and how successful it was and what happened to it.
Sure. I mean, we could talk for hours and hours about it. I'll try to give some important markers in the history of Turkish banking and try to draw out some of the key points or key lessons to be learned. So one thing in Turkey, but which is almost universal to most developing countries or peripheral countries, whatever, however you want to refer to them, is that the state-owned banks, public banks, the creation of them around the late 1800s, but more early 1900s, earliest 20th century, governments actively began to create or nationalize existing private banks so that they could push forward with development and push forward in a way that had some sort of national autonomy where the political will could shape the nature of development in those countries. Mainstream mythology today asserts that state-owned banks only sort of fill in where there's a market gap or a market failure type thing. And in reality, that doesn't capture the historical reality of it all, where the public banks were created yes, of course, because the private sector couldn't do it, but they also didn't want to do it, and they had no interest in taking on the massive projects of infrastructure and industrialization and all these things that public banks had a really key role in. And such was the case in Turkey. In particular, Ziraat Bank, the agricultural bank, in the late 1800s was created and then took on a very key role in promoting agricultural development, but also trying to scrape away some sense of independence from European powers that had basically colonized and taken over the administration, what's called the Odious Debt Administration of Turkey, where basically the Sultan at the time had handed over power of finances to the Ottoman Bank, the European-controlled bank. So the creation of the state-owned banks at that time were very much an issue of countervailing force, but of also creating projects and supporting farmers and cooperatives and that, like, things like that. And they worked relatively well and solidly for decades, not for years, but for, you know, up to 7 or 8 decades. And in that process, developed significant capacity not only to create and distribute credit and money and support particular types of projects, but also expertise around farming, around trade, small, medium-sized enterprises, around infrastructure development. And so the development banks and the commercial banks had that sort of internal capacity to support projects nationally. Now, enter the 1970s and 1980s, and growing power of private banks, and in Turkey you get quite a rapid attempt at financial liberalization in the early 1980s under military rule, basically, and you immediately get a private banking crisis in 1982. So you see at that point that while Turkey is going through a neoliberal transformation in general, that sort of crisis and bailout, the socialization of the private debts in 1982, led to a slowing down of any attempt to immediately privatize the state-owned banks in Turkey. But what you do get in this sort of neoliberal, very boom-bust type of economic transition that you see throughout the developing world and emerging markets is that during the 1990s, you see what is a very real challenge, real problem of state-owned banks that are not effectively democratized, is that you get the various coalition governments and right-wing governments of Turkey trying to push forward with the neoliberal transition by using the state-owned banks. And they had this particular mechanism called the duty loss. And the government effectively used the state-owned banks to hide billions of dollars in expenses, and government, and basically use the banks to generate new funds and fund sectors of the economy to help them sort of smooth the transition to neoliberalism, but without ever paying back the public banks. This is the problem. Not that public banks can do this, but the government, in a very corrupt way, did abuse the state-owned banks. And that contributed to the 2001 a major financial crisis in Turkey. The implications of that were not to deepen democracy in Turkey or to set up effective lines of representation and accountability in the state-owned banks, but a very severe market-oriented restructuring of the state-owned banks and a very harsh institutional changes that severed the historic capacity, in the sense of governments, to mobilize the state-owned banks for development, and basically institutionally severed that, and then imposed very clear market-oriented and profit-oriented and profit-maximizing imperatives on the state-owned banks. So it led to a fairly harsh commercialization, marketization process of the state-owned banks, which is, in subsequent interviews, has not really been in the interest of the bulk of the population of Turkey, and particularly not the workers in the state-owned banks who had to absorb that harsh restructuring, with a third of them being laid off and these sorts of things. So the lesson that's important there, again, is a question of political will. Political will at that time was to neoliberalize the banks. And you can equally undo that and reclaim and resuscitate a lot of the important functions of public banks that still find their ways through the state-owned banks today, even though they have been marketized, still, nonetheless, they maintain important roles, and there's a public ethos in them, and the operations of the state-owned banks can be such that they need not respond to profit imperatives. They need not respond only to market demands, but that has to be mobilized around a wider social project and a popular project of effectively capturing the state-owned banks and working with them on very progressive economic and political goals.
You wrote about how the remarkable Chinese development that we all know about, like the last 30 years, I think they were growing at 10% a year right up until recently, which is amazing, but that much of it was funded by their state-owned banks. But I've heard that they too, are sort of succumbing. I mean, they send their young people to the U.S. to be educated, and then they go back with their neoliberal ideas. And so they, too, seem to be, to some extent, falling for the neoliberal mantra. Do you have any insights on that?
I'm not an expert on Chinese banking. It is true that Chinese leadership has been moving much more towards what they call capitalism with Chinese characteristics. You know, that then bleeds through to the state enterprises held within the state. But of course, I think the issue there is, again, the question of political and popular will and the extent to which there is any desire within Chinese leadership to democratize the public and state-owned banks. And I suspect probably not. And hence, you're getting the training of officials and things like that abroad, trying to bring back ideas about how, in a sense, to insulate state-owned banks from broader political will. And this, in effect, is the second best, if you will, option for market advocates. The first one, of course, is privatization, that if you have a public bank or public enterprise, that you ought to sell it off and let the markets and private sector control it. If you can't do that for whatever reasons, economic, political, and these sorts of things, then it's best to find ways to internalize and institutionalize the logic of the market, to neoliberalize, marketize them. And I suspect this might be what you're referring to in terms of the training of Chinese diplomats and state technicians and things like that. But, you know, it all fits in the wider context. And the question is whether or not social forces on the ground in China or Turkey or Mexico or wherever are going to hold their leadership to account, and whether or not we, the public, can take back control over banks and money. And this is the real key political project, I think. And this is really the question of, in a sense, a failure of social movements, many social movements, not all, and of the left, and of Marxists in particular, to seriously consider this question of where is finance and banking and alternatives in our questions of change and alternatives to neoliberalism. It's been a massive blind spot for us, with many progressive scholars who critique finance and have very eloquent and correct analyses of the problems that have been magnified under neoliberalism in the last 20 or 30 years, have little to nothing to say about what then to replace it with, and very little, if any, concrete evidence on the actual existing alternatives that we can look to across the globe of really interesting people working in really interesting public banks and doing really great things. Like a few months ago, I was, again, point to Costa Rica because it's so interesting, happened to have a presentation of a local cooperative group producing electricity in a sort of small northern community, northeastern corner of Costa Rica, slightly isolated within the country, about 60,000 members as part of this cooperative, who are directly supported by the National Bank of Costa Rica through supportive loans, supportive financing, long-term financing, that sort of thing. And they're producing zero emission electricity, no carbon impact, and they're also distributing internet services to their members at least 25% cheaper than you can get from the closest private provider. So these are significant real examples that you can look at where there's things like solidarity production, cooperative production of electricity, being supported by public banks in ways that enable environmental goals, social solidarity goals, long-term development, these sorts of things. But the left has really not been concerned with that or not really engaged with it and are more interested in pounding their fist on the table and say, we need to smash finance, we need to smash banks. And then what? That's the question. And that's the question I'm hoping to answer. And I think you're trying to answer yourself as well. You know, what needs to be done in terms of this question of banking public banking and alternatives.
I think one problem is that people have not understood the function of banks, that we've been sold this idea that banks just take in deposits and lend them out again, that they're just intermediaries. And so that sounds like something you can leave to the private sector. But when you realize that banks actually create our money, and in fact they create nearly all of our money, then it's obviously something that should belong to the public sector. And in England, the positive money people managed to get a hearing on that, and now you have a potential political candidate who might bring it up. And then we also have all the data from quantitative easing, which under the conventional theory, that should lead to hyperinflation, but obviously it hasn't. So people just don't understand all these mechanisms. And if they did understand it, it seems to me then it would become rather obvious that this should be a public function. It should not be something left to the private sector.
I agree, of course. I think understanding is a very key element of it, and the understanding the nature of money, the nature of credit, the nature of banks, and these sorts of things. You started talking about banks, intermediation, these sorts of things. One of the common things you hear is that, what we need to do is just get back to the real business of banking, which is intermediation, what they were meant to do, in a sense. But this is actually another mythology, in a sense, that, a private banker is concerned with their business. They're not necessarily concerned just with making loans. They're concerned, first and foremost, with making money. They don't wake up in the morning as a private banker and say, listen, this morning I need to go out and do some real good intermediation. They're actually saying, we need to create some money today so I can make more money out of that. My job is to make money out of money. And that's what I'm concerned with. And under corporate capitalism in particular, that timeline for making money is shortened and shortened and shortened. And the pressures to make more money are intensified through share ownership and, quarterly report and then listing on the stock exchange, these sorts of things. So they're in the business of intermediation, not to intermediate, but to make more and more money, right? And this is why it's vital to release banks from that imperative. And you can't release the banks from that imperative under a private corporatized system. It's simply impossible. And that's not their reason to be. You can do this under public banks. Public banks have existed for decades, if not actually centuries, as you yourself note in your book. Some of the earliest banks go back to the 1400s. Barcelona, city banks, local banks, they've existed all through the last several centuries. And they haven't necessarily existed as a profit-maximizing enterprise, but to give some what you can call policy space to governments in terms of managing their own affairs, to create money, to create credit. Most money today is credit money. And then if that's then under the control of the private sector, then you get the disciplinary impact of that, of you either repay or there are going to be consequences. And the consequences have been increasingly severe in terms of the rule of law, private property protections, which basically means that large private corporate banks can do whatever the hell they want in terms of repossessing homes and trying to recover their private property without the risk. And this is the problem with the bailouts in the U.S. and globally since 2008, 2009, is that they've really found ways to manage risk in a way that intensify profits, but without ever accepting the responsibilities for losses. And effectively, there's little risk of capital loss in the private sector, because they become socialized at times of crisis. So again, these sorts of things, I'm an academic, obviously I deal in a lot of the deeper debates and things like that, but for us is to make understandable the alternatives to what exists today, the potential of them, but also be sober about the political will that is needed to push through with these changes. We can't just hope it to come about, but there has to be real mobilization around it, because there's no avoiding the fact that the power of private corporatized banking today is enormous and is deeply rooted in our societies and in the way in which we view banks, exactly as you were saying, and in the rule of law and in the very institutions of government. There has to be a lot of rewriting of the sort of rules and regulations in different countries to enable public banks to succeed as they could and should in an alternative project. I guess I want to emphasize, it's not really an economic issue. It's a political and social issue. And there's no reason why we can't take back banks, other than the fact that there are massive power relations there. And any real attempt to sort of push back against the logic of private, profit-oriented money creation, of making more money out of controlling money, really meets with very savage responses on behalf of the private sector. We have to be equally prepared to respond to that with rational, well-evidenced, popular arguments about democratization and the control of money.
Well, that's very inspiring. It's great to hear you make all those arguments. I guess we've come to the end of our time, but it's been really great talking to you. Do you have a website or anything you'd like to add for people to get in touch with you?
I don't have a separate personal website, but you can always, if anyone is interested, they can look me up in my university website at SOAS University of London, Thomas Marwa. You can Google that, and it should pop up quite easily. And I would be happy to discuss these sorts of issues with people. I'm doing a lot of research on the topic, and there is certainly growing interest in this topic, and I'm sure you've witnessed it yourself in the Public Banking Institute. So, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you, and I hope that we continue this conversation and it becomes a much wider, involved discussion, not only in the U.S., the U.K., but globally.
Yep, I'm sure we will. Thank you so much. My guest today has been Dr. Thomas Marwa, a senior lecturer at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London.
You may have heard that presidential candidate Bernie Sanders recently endorsed the concept of postal banking, the idea that the U.S. Postal Service should revive much and perhaps more of the sort of small-scale banking services that you could accomplish at every post office around the U.S. as late as 1962. Well, maybe that's not so recent, but a tradition of service nonetheless that characterized not only the U.S. post office, but post offices around the world. These are community centers where people would get business done of various types. The reasons for reviving it here in the U.S. now are many. Post offices are in virtually every neighborhood in America, many of which no longer have community banks to service them, since some of these communities are not rich profit centers, and where many people are not really bankable, at least from the standpoint of a for-profit commercial bank. And yet still, they need the sort of services that we all do, whether it's to cash a check or conduct some other basic banking tasks. Another reason for restoring this line of business at the post office is that it would be another profit center for the USPS, which has been financially challenged by an onerous congressional mandate to forward fund its pension funds 75 years. But these are the obvious considerations. Matt Stannard has another aspect of this development that bears consideration on this week's Public Banking Report.
This week, I published an article at Occupy.com on the growing interest and sudden resurgence of interest in banking at the United States Post Office. I made 6 points about postal banking, the United States Post Office, the threat of privatization, the threat of payday lenders. You can read the article there if you want. There's also a podcast of a conversation I had with Mark Armstrong about postal banking, and there's certainly a lot to talk about. But now I want to talk about one small subpoint of a point that I made in that article. That's the role of post offices as commons, common spaces. The post office is actually an incredible business and would run at an absolute profit rather than the relative profit they run under now, but for prohibitive legislation and the moving of regulatory goalposts. More than that, the scale of the USPS is huge, and it represents both the triumphs and the occasional problems of large-scale enterprises. Post offices are also more than businesses, and the standards by which we judge social enterprises ought to be different than the criteria for profit-based success. The post office links us together as a nation. We send material and money to one another, words and packages of things, and we do so through branches of the commons that are both unique and universal. It's not just touchy-feely good to conduct our affairs in common spaces. It's also good policy. Having strong central community facilities that'll continue to operate no matter the direction of the trade winds, and even more importantly, social organizations that will continue to operate in disasters or other wide-scale emergencies. That's good policymaking. And so it is that one of the most, if not the most, beautiful post offices in the country, the James A. Farley Post Office between Madison Square Garden and Penn Station in New York City, constructed in 1912, this gorgeous, almost palatial post office was instrumental in the wake of the tragic attacks against New York City on September 11, 2001. The office continued mail and remittance services and all of its services while the city was in chaos. Now, portions of the building are being progressively taken by Penn Station and turned into what will be Daniel Patrick Moynihan Station, which I suppose is nice, but the main post office will remain in operation. It's a better fate than some branches are getting around the country. You can visit a site called SaveThePostOffice.com to learn more about that. As a way of cutting artificially imposed losses, the USPS is pressured by politicians who work for Wall Street to sell historical buildings to private developers. It makes me angry and sad, and again, not just because of their beauty, not just because of their communal significance, but because only public control and management of the postal commons ensures that we can keep the post rolling in good times and bad. The notion of common spaces being collectively managed as utilities to, among other things, help people out when they're in trouble is also what public banking is all about. And in particular, banking through the post office seems especially tailored to the service of individuals facing financial challenges. And again, that's not just about feeling good. It's also good policy. The banking deserts that exist now, with upwards of 100 million people unable to access inexpensive and stable financial services, that's bad policy. It causes more poverty because it's so costly to be poor. It encourages predatory lending, which further impoverishes communities. And at a time when hundreds of millions of us cannot afford even a $400 emergency, economic desperation makes bad public policy and bad personal policy. Over the past 2 years, we've seen private entities try to fill in those gaps. They talk about new banking, the way that people talk about new capitalism. But I predict those schemes will keep falling short, as they have so far, for the same reason Bank of America recently announced it would abandon many small town budgets. Because large sections of America are simply not compatible with the profit-driven model of big banking, no matter how you repackage it. Which brings us back to the commons, and common management, and public service, and the post office. We know the USPS can improve its financial status by reopening banking services at very modest rates. We know the post office as an institution is highly trusted, has huge economies of scale, and stewardship of common spaces, community spaces all over the nation, particularly in communities where the banks have died out. So the recent resurgence in the drive for postal banking promises to offer a commons-based solution to an increasingly common problem. I'm Matt Stannard, and this has been the Public Banking Report.
That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary and the blog discussions, which are really quite invigorating and informative, by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!